One of the most iconic images of World War II is the B-17 bomber. We're going to talk about that aircraft with our guest today. I'm Jill Nadeau, in for the vacationing Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Our guest is George Dobner. He is the pilot operation manager for the EAA B-17 tour. George is a former corporate pilot and has flown the B-17 for many years. He is also a longtime board member of the Vintage Aircraft Association. The EAA's B-17, called the Aluminum Overcast, is coming into the Dane County Regional Airport today and will be open for tours through Sunday. We'll talk about the history of the B-17, the upcoming EAA fly-in, and of course, take your questions and comments. Join by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Hi, George.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful myself. The phone has been ringing this morning as our crew is trying to get from Oshkosh to Madison with the B-17.
I'll bet.
And the weather has been giving us just a little bit of pain, but it will be there in time for the 2 o'clock media flight.
Wonderful, so. Wonderful. Because, yeah, it was raining down here in Madison today, so glad to hear that it's on schedule. Tell me, what was it like for you to pilot the Aluminum Overcast for the first time?
Oh, gosh, that's an interesting question. I was a corporate pilot basically my whole life, 25 years as a corporate pilot out of Milwaukee. So flying a multi-engine airplanes around the country was something that I was extraordinarily used to. It was my life.
Mm-hmm.
I was given the opportunity because I had a significant amount of what we call multi-engine tailwheel experience, which is the older type of aircraft from the 30s and the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that background because it's different flying an old tail dragger airplane versus what you would consider to be a normal type airplane with a nose wheel.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The airplanes fly much differently. So the first time I got into the B-17, and let me expand one little bit more here.
Sure.
About 4 years before that, I was going through the museum and where the B-17 was housed, and this was before it started going out on tour. And I remember climbing up into the plane, sitting in the pilot's seat, and looking out at that wing and the two large engines on the left side of the airplane and going, oh, my God, what would it be like to fly this airplane?
Mm.
And then all of a sudden in 1995, I was given the opportunity because Paul Popresny, our founder, would fly the airplane around the Oshkosh area, and he'd take short notice trips places. And he didn't really have a second pilot to fly with him that was qualified in that type of airplane. So that's how I got into it.
Okay.
So the first time I climb in the plane, and I'm just, you know, there's a little bit of being overwhelmed. You have to sit there and kind of pull it all back in and go, wait a minute, it's an airplane.
Okay.
It's a tail dragger. This is the way you're going to fly it. And it worked for me because I had an awful lot of experience in a plane called a Ford Trimotor, which you probably never heard of, but Henry Ford designed it with some aviation folks back in the mid-20s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first all-metal air transport that ever flew in this country. So I had that experience, and that really helped me fit comfortably and make it through those first few days in the B-17 until I developed the confidence that, hey, I can deal with this airplane.
Sure.
You know, it's so different from what I was used to prior to that. Now, I have flown it from 1995 until now, and I've got 1,600 hours of flying the airplane. I'm probably one of the highest time B-17 pilots in the country. But every flight is a little bit different. And as I tell the pilots that work for myself and the team, that every takeoff and every landing, you have to have the same intensity that you had the first time you flew it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the plane was designed in 1934. It was built in the last half of 34 and the first half of 35. And so it's considering when it was designed and when it was built, it is absolutely iconic in the jump that it made from airplanes of the 20s to the mid-30s. The technological jump was incredible. So that's basically, that's a long answer to your question, but the first time I flew it, I was so concentrating on not making a mistake,
right,
and not doing something stupid that, you know, and that's what you, that's, you have to have that kind of intensity when you fly the plane.
Sure. I think probably any plane, right? I mean, it's a long way down.
That's a good point.
Yes.
And by the way, I don't like heights.
Oh no.
I'm serious. I don't like looking over the edge of a mountain that goes down 4,000 or 5,000 feet. I was a skier out in Aspen for years. And but when I'm in that airplane, and when I'm in any airplane, mm-hmm. because I'm in control,
yeah.
I know that I'm a good pilot, and part of what makes you a good pilot is respecting the airplane, respecting the environment that you fly in, and making good decisions on days that you shouldn't fly because, you know, conditions aren't right for it.
Sure.
And being able to balance that, not letting your ego get in the way, that's what it takes to be a good B-17 pilot.
Wonderful. Well, I hope your people who are flying the planes I'm in are always like you, George, because I appreciate that. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the history of this particular plane?
Well, this airplane did not see the war. It was on the ramp in California, fully fueled and ready to go when the war ended. So this airplane and six others were basically put up for salvage. Okay. They were offered to anybody that wanted to purchase one. And you could buy the airplane off that ramp for less than it costs us to fill the entire airplane with fuel today.
Oh my.
Okay. and the fact that it was on that ramp and that it was in fact sold to a company that utilized it, got it out of what we disaffectionately call the daisy chain from Europe to Kingman, Arizona, where the B-17s that fought in the war were chopped up.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that this airplane was sold to somebody that put it into some type of commercial freight type usage at that time saved that airplane and those other five as well. And three of those airplanes are still flying today.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, you know, 12,731 B-17s were built.
Wow.
And in your lead-in, you mentioned only 15 are flyable. Mm-hmm. And that's a fact. So mm-hmm. compare those two numbers.
Yeah, that's a big, big difference. Well, it's a very unique thing that you have there. We do have a caller, a listener calling Peggy in Mondovi, and she has a question for you. Hi, Peggy.
Sure.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My dad was a bombardier on B-24s, and I never heard him use the word tail dragger to describe that kind of aircraft. Could you explain what that means?
Oh, absolutely. The B-24 was, in fact, a tri-gear type aircraft. It and the B-25, the one that was used by Doolittle in his raid, those were both tri-gear airplanes. The B-17 was the first large bomber, and it was a tail dragger. So the third wheel in a tail dragger is back under the tail of the airplane, under horizontal and vertical stabilizers, as opposed to the nose wheel being up in the front of the plane. That is technically the difference.
So the wheels in the back instead of the front.
That is correct.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Well, thanks for asking, Peggy. Yeah, George, go ahead.
I did really cut short your original question. The plane was sold. It did freight work in Florida and to Central and South America. It was taken over to the Asian continent and mapped the entire Asian continent. And then eventually worked its way back to the United States, where it went to work for a company in Dothan, Alabama, the Wheelless Corporation. And they, used it to spray fire ants in the southeast. Fire ants were a big problem, mm-hmm. and they used multiple B-17s to sit there and control fire ants. The plane then wound up in, I believe it was Griffin, Georgia, where it was it and two of the other airplanes were parked that were on the, of those six that were in the on the California ramp when the war ended, and they all went their separate ways. A group of doctors purchased, that were all EAA members, okay?
Uh-huh.
They purchased the plane with the intention of being kind of a first of Doctors Without Borders type of thing, where they were going to fly around the world, and they were going to sit there and use the airplane as their vehicle to go to various countries and take care of people that needed doctors. Well, all that was planned about the same time as OPEC decided to sit there and screw around with the price of oil. And these doctors, being men of, you know, they had money, they were all, you know, leaders in their field, but they could not afford the fuel that was going to be needed after OPEC, after the price of oil skyrocketed, which meant the price of aviation fuel skyrocketed, and they could not afford it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But they wanted the plane to do something useful. So what they did was they donated it to the EAA with the understanding that eventually we would restore it back to what it looked like during World War II, take it out on a tour and salute the World War II veterans, what Brokaw talks about, the greatest generation, generation saved the world. That lady that called and asked me that question, I forget, was her father or her uncle. That man was a hero.
Oh, yes.
He was an American patriot.
Mm-hmm.
These guys put their lives on the line every single day with knowing that the odds were so stacked against them to ever get home back to the United States, because as an air crew, their life expectancy wasn't very good at the beginning of that war.
It certainly wasn't.
There's a 30% chance that on any given flight, remember they had to fly 25 flights, the Memphis Belle thing?
Mm-hmm, yep.
They had to fly 25 flights before they could go home, and there was a 30% chance on any one of those flights that they weren't going to make it back. So work those numbers out, and your percentage is pretty darn low.
Yeah.
American heroes.
Definitely. Well, we're talking about the B-17 today with George Dobner. He's the pilot operations manager for the EAA B-17 tour. What comments do you have about this aircraft? Do you have a relative who flew one? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Jane Rotunda is our on-air producer today, and Dave Potras is our technical director. After 11:45, we'll talk about the American Players Theater in Spring Green. They're celebrating their 40th anniversary this year. Hope you can stay with us on the Ideas Network. But right now, let's get back to talking with George Dobner about the B-17. George, we've got some calls coming in. Let's go to Dean in Mount Horeb. Hi, Dean.
Hi. I've been a military and commercial airline pilot for over 45 years, and I'm still in awe of the guys who flew this. There's a book out, it's been out about 15 years, it's called Masters of the Air, and it's an excellent book about what the members of the 8th Air Force put up with. You know, you have to remember, these were 18, 19, 20-year-old guys flying this, and as your guest mentioned, their life expectancy was not that great. You know, it was not uncommon for them to lose hundreds of guys in one day. This book even mentions that the 8th Air Force lost more people in World War II than the entire U.S. Marine Corps. It's amazing that these young guys would get in that plane day after day after day, not knowing whether to come back. And the B-17 was the workhorse of that.
Yeah, certainly. Thank you, Dean. George, you can... agree with that, I'm sure.
Oh, I totally agree with it. Mm-hmm. And not a lot of people know what he just said.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the fact that more air crew crew members died than Marines during the war. People just really have a hard time comprehending that. But like he also said, they would send up a large flight of B-17s, and an incredible number of them did not make it back. You had the Luftwaffe that owned, in the early part of the war, owned the airspace. Once they got deeper into Germany, into that area, they had the anti-aircraft, which, again, just devastated our aircraft. And, of course, we were doing daylight bombing, where the Brits were doing the night bombing. So it even made it a little bit – it made it harder for our crews to get in and out undetected and to be able to sit there and determine, you know, the Germans could determine what altitude, and they could get those anti-aircraft up there, and it was devastating. It truly was.
And it went, it flew 8 hours, and consequently there weren't any fighters that went along with it. So they were out there on their own, sitting ducks sometimes, right?
Until the Mustang really came on scene, the coverage from fighters that were there, escort fighters, really was not that good. And so, you know, each one of these aircraft, now you know, we talk about them being the Flying Fortress. Mm-hmm. They had 13 50 caliber machine guns on each one of those airplanes. And the strength and the safety of that flight was in a tightly knit flight formation, where all 13 guns on each one of those airplanes sat there and offered kind of a dome of protection. But that, it, you know, against a good ME-109 type pilot, it was difficult to sit there and protect the formation. And then, of course, the ME-109s disappeared, and that was a bad omen because that meant that the anti-aircraft was coming up.
Sure.
So, you know, it was very tough for them to sit there and survive. And I enjoyed the Memphis Belle, the newer version of the Memphis Belle, because it spent the movie, because
yes,
it spent time, you know, talking about and showing each one of the crew members. They all had something that could occupy their mind, you know, fidget with their hands, whatever. Mm-hmm. Whatever they did, one guy taking pictures, another guy, all kinds of different things that they would do. Because the fact remained that if they allowed themselves to think about what they were about to do, I don't know how they could possibly, you know, deal with it because of the fact that the rate of loss was so high. They talk about Morgan. I had a privilege of meeting him in Asheville, North Carolina, many years ago on one of our flights, and he flew a press flight with us. And his way of dealing with the stress of flying and the stress of being the aircraft commander, the leader of that 10-man crew, he had all the pressure on him. And his way of dealing with it was to upset his co-pilot by saying, let's rerun the checklist. And the co-pilot was sick of it. And he didn't understand why. It was Morgan's way of mentally coping with the pressure of being the leader and being responsible for the other 9 lives.
Mm-hmm.
When they got off that airplane after a 25th mission, Morgan just let himself go. The movie showed him popping a bottle of wine and going crazy with the crew. He never would have let his emotion show before that. But when that 25th mission was behind him, the movie showed that he expressed all that emotion that he'd been bottling up.
Yeah.
And that's what a leader has to do.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Thank you, Dean, for those comments. Let's go to Jim in Sheboygan now. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I got to tour a B-17 at the Sheboygan County Airport many years ago. It was called A Sentimental Journey, and it was owned by the Confederate Air Force. I was surprised at the closeness of the quarters in there, that 10 men could fit in that fuselage. Astounded me. I was wondering if that was one of the 5 that was saved at the end of World War II.
No, I believe Sentimental Journey actually flew in the war. Now, there's a slight difference between our airplane and Sentimental Journey. Okay, Sentimental Journey is 100% exactly as a B-17 would be during the war. It had the upper turret in it that is located right behind the pilot and co-pilot, just in front of the, we call it the bulkhead number four, in the back of the, back of the cockpit. And that made it almost impossible for people to move around in the plane. And because our intention was to take it on the road, salute veterans, get as many people as possible to be able to enjoy themselves in that plane, we did not put the upper turret in because it made it much, much easier for people to move around. And keep in mind, you know, we're in the air. When we're taking these people up, they're in the air for 24 minutes, and they don't have their seatbelts on. And, you know, we all remember what happened a couple of weeks ago when an aircraft, you know, hit some serious turbulence and people are bouncing off the ceiling. And, you know, so we wanted to kind of minimize the sharp things that could sit and actually hurt somebody, a passenger in the airplane. So that makes our airplane a little easier to move around in. But at the end of the day, your original statement, how small it is, you know, you look at that airplane and you think, oh, you know, it's got to be big inside, and it's not. It is small. It's very tight quartered. And I always tell everybody, it's not a 747. It does not have friendly edges. When you're walking around inside the airplane, you make sure you have a hand touching something in case, you know, you can find chop and turbulence. We try not to sit there and fly if it's a really miserable day from the standpoint of turbulence, because we, you know, this is supposed to be fun for people. Mm-hmm. We don't want to sit there and take people out and scare them or injure somebody. And so, yes, it's very small inside. And but it was built to be a war machine, and it served that purpose very well. It was, like I said earlier, it was iconic from a technology standpoint, from the technological leap from the 20s to the 30s and 40s. It was also absolutely iconic because of the American kids, and that's what they were.
Certainly.
Captains, many of the captains were only 21, 22 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's from the aspect of the kids that flew those airplanes and did it day in and day out, knowing their life was at risk. Just something that this country, especially with everything that's going on now, we have to go back and remember this is who we were then, and this is really who we are now. Just got a little bump in the road right now. So.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that comment. And let's go to Rick. He is an Oshkosh, and he has something to expand on. His father was on a B-17. Hi, Rick.
Right. Hello. Thank you for the call, and thank you for the program. Very interesting. And I have to say to your guest, I had never heard the stat about more Army Air Corps people dying than Marines in World War II. So that was just an incredible piece of knowledge to pick up. I just wanted to mention my father was a nose gunner on a B-17 and was shot down over Magdeburg, Germany, toward the end of World War II. He was POW for 4 months. And I guess as I get older, I appreciate those sacrifices far more than maybe I used to. So anyway, thank you for the program, and I hold his memorabilia, his jacket, squadron patch, and all that forever.
Well, thank you so much, Rick. That, George, was an extremely dangerous place to be, wasn't it?
It was a dangerous place to be, but on that airplane, any really part of it was dangerous. Do you remember they had a Disney movie where a landing, it was like kind of a cartoon thing, and one of the wheels didn't come down, and they were talking about the ball turret actually crushing.
Yes.
The ball turret actually was much stronger than people realized, and if in fact something like that happened, the ball turret generally would just go straight up into the fuselage. And the post that it was mounted on would just poke itself out the top.
Ah.
But the thing that the ball turret, And you got to hear this whole thing out.
And if just to stop you, just to remind people that that's the like the bubble on the bottom of the plane.
It's right. It's the bubble. It's the bubble on the bottom. If that airplane if the airplane gets on the ground in one piece, the ball turret was probably the safest place to be in the airplane. If they had a bailout of that airplane, the ball turret was the most dangerous place to be because the ball turret gunner was in the ball turret and he did not have room for his parachute.
Oh, that's right.
So if the captain sat there, the aircraft commander said, abandon ship, he had to get the opening of the ball turret in, you know, so that the opening was in the fuselage, climb out of the fuselage, grab his parachute, strap it on, and then get to the door, which wasn't that far away, but it was still about 12, 14 feet away from the rear door. Well, the problem is usually the captain did not call abandon ship unless it was really bad, which meant that it was probably starting to spiral out of control.
Yeah.
And that would set up a centrifugal force in that plane where if you were not out of it when it started really spinning, you probably weren't going to be able to get out of it. Mm-hmm. And that ball turret guy, it was going to take him probably a full minute from the time that they got the call to the time he could get out of that plane. So many ball turret gunners did not get out. That was probably, if the plane went down, and many of them did, that was the most dangerous place to be in the airplane.
Okay. Now, you're going to have a special media flight this afternoon. And, well, our executive producer, Jane Rotunda, and I are lucky enough to be among the passengers. I'm very much looking forward to it. But you're going to have an honored guest riding with us, and he has a remarkable story. Why don't you tell us about him?
I don't have all his information. I have been so busy over the last couple of days getting ready for AirVenture that I do not have all his information.
Okay.
Do you have it?
Well, from what I remember reading, and I don't remember the name, unfortunately, I think it was Mueller, but he's a Holocaust survivor who lives in Illinois. And his basic comment about it was that he remembers being in, well, he was in a number of different camps, but he could see the B-15 or the B-17s coming over, and it would be like black in the sky, and they were so excited to see them that they knew that liberation wasn't too far away. So, it's a pretty emotional story. But
sit there and to think of what those poor people went through, in concentration camps, I can't even comprehend it.
No.
Because and then like you said, to be able to look up and see those American bombers and to realize that, hey, the rest of the world has not forgotten us.
Yes.
And that has got to give you something to cling to.
Oh, yes.
As a human being.
Absolutely. Well, we do have a lot of callers, so let's go to David in Green Bay next. Hi, David.
Hi. When I was a young guy in Upper Michigan, I got a job helping an older guy. He owned a trailer park, and I worked with him a couple summers. And then one day we were talking, and he said he was in World War II, and I said, well, what'd you do there? And imagine this, I'm talking with him for a good year or year and a half, working with him and helping him out of that. He owned the trailer park anyways, but he was a navigator on a B-17 and never was shot down, but had an awful lot of holes put in his plane. He had pictures and stuff. But after, he took me into his house and was showing me he had the jacket, and then he some photographs, but he was telling me that they didn't wear their parachutes in there. It's one thing stands out in my mind, that they had to get their parachutes on. If that plane started going down, they had to get them on and then jump out the Bombay door. That was his job. But he was telling me it took miles and miles for them to get to altitude, and when they got to altitude, they had to watch their breathing because their regulators could freeze up. And he said, he's telling about some of these stories, and it was later in the war, and he said a 20-millimeter round went right through the side of the plane, went right through the plane and missed him by a foot when he was in his navigator.
But
it's so matter-of-fact,
it's
just like, well, this is what we did. And then he introduced me to one of his friends that flew Mustangs in World War. And I saw these two guys for years walking around, and none of them ever talked about it. But once I got them to talk about it, it's just amazing that what they did and the danger they were in. And people just got to know this history. And I went through the B-17 years ago at EAA, and I thought of that old guy Bob that I worked for, and I thought, my God, I can't even fit in this chair.
Oh, well, thank you, David. He certainly gave you a wonderful gift with those stories. George, I'm sure you've heard this many, many times.
I have, and I remember one World War II veteran that was a waist gunner. Okay, now a waist gunner, there's two of them. There's one on the left and there's one on the right side of the airplane. And the waist is that area from, you could sit there and say, from the back of the wing to where the tail would be attached to the airplane. Right smack in the middle of that is what they call the waist. And this one fellow was saying, I was shooting away, and we had just cleared the fighters had just pulled off, and again, remember in my comment, that was a bad omen because that meant the anti-aircraft was coming. And he said the first shell that came up near them exploded, and the man said it ripped a hole, about a 4 or 5 inch hole, in the fuselage, just like that gentleman just said, very, very, very close to him. And it was a large piece of that anti-aircraft shell, and it had fallen to the floor, and it was just smoldering.
Mm.
And he pulled his hand out of his pocket and handed me the piece of shrapnel.
Oh.
And I was flabbergasted at the size of it and just sitting there thinking how many Americans died from something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It just amplifies.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. what these people meant to us.
Yeah. Lots of stories, lots of history in that plane. And well, let's tell people how they can get a little closer to it. You're going to be in Madison and through Sunday, right?
We're going to be in Madison through Sunday. Mm-hmm. The plane will be leaving at approximately 5:30, 6 o'clock, heading up to Appleton, where we base the airplane out of Appleton during Air Venture. Mm-hmm. Because it is a significantly sized airplane, and we try not to sit there and operate it out of Oshkosh simply because of all the small, fast-moving aircraft that are in that area, in that confined area during Air Venture itself.
Yeah.
So we can safely, very safely, keep our level of safety sky high by operating out of Appleton. We do flyovers over the top of Air Venture,
mm-hmm.
So everybody gets a chance, in the airplane gets a chance to see the facility, and then we're back to Appleton, and we run flights out of Appleton all week. So we'll be at Wisconsin Aviation. The plane should be arriving there sometime in the next, I would guess, the next hour. We will be doing ground tours on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in the afternoon. We have four flights scheduled each day in the morning, starting, I believe, at 10. I got to double check if there's any change on the schedule. No, it'll be 10, 11, 12, and 1 o'clock. Ground tours then from 1 until 5 or 5:30. If we have additional demand for flights, we'll fly a couple more flights in the evening. So we could theoretically fly up to probably 18 flights while we're in Madison. While the ground tours are very attractively priced, we want the families to be able to come out and take their kids through the airplane. We want them to be able to, we want the kids to be able to see what these great American heroes, what the inside of that airplane looks like. Part of our mission is to entice young people to get involved in aviation. And so the B-17 is one of those tools. I mentioned in the beginning, saluting veterans. Well, the second most important part of this is to expose the youth of America to the enjoyment of being a pilot and of aviation. So that's what we're doing out there. And then obviously, they can purchase flights from the on-site tour coordinator, or they can call our B-17 phone number, which you already have, and make a reservation with our membership department. And so that's basically, and of course, when they buy a ground tour ticket, that means they can crawl around that airplane for hours if they want. because a lot of kids, I mean, I've watched kids go in and out of that thing, 10 times looking at different things each time, because you get inside the plane and you're overwhelmed the first time.
Oh, yeah.
You have to go back a second time and go, okay, wait a minute. I want to see what that cockpit looks like. I want to see what that ball turret looks like, or whatever the case is. So, that's pretty much the what we're doing. This is called Heavy Bomber Weekend. The second B-29 that's flying, it's called DOC, it will be there. In fact, one of our vice presidents will be one of the pilots on DOC as well. And so there'll be numerous World War II aircraft there. So they will be able, anybody that comes out to Wisconsin Aviation this weekend will get to see many of the warbirds that flew during World War II, and were all part and parcel of that generation that saved the world.
Great. And there's a hangar dance, I believe, on Saturday night also.
I believe there is. Yes, I believe there's a hangar dance as well. Yes.
So
we've been doing this in Madison or in Janesville for probably 10 years now, just weekend before AirVenture, and they always have a hangar dance associated with it, just to get people out and kind of see how everybody let their hair down, in the evenings.
Sure, absolutely. Okay, well, George, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us about this, and good luck, and hopefully we'll get a lot of people out there to appreciate these wonderful machines.
Well, like I said, I've been doing this since 1995, and it is I myself as one of the I am the operations manager for the program, but as a pilot, you are part of a team. There's six of us out there.
Wonderful.
Two of them maintaining, two of them doing the ticket sales, and two of them flying it. And it's just a team, and the team loves what they're doing because of how much it means to our country.
Sure. Well, thank you again, George. We've been talking with George Dobner. He's the pilot operations manager for the EAA B-17 tour. You can find out more about the tour and the plane if you go to b17.org. That's b17.org. And stay with us on the Ideas Network, because coming up next, we're celebrating 40 years of exceptional theater with the American Players Theater Group. Stay with us.